We continue today in the book of Ezekiel, chapter number 20, where we will pick up at verse number 39. The year is 592 BC. It's summer. It's the late part of July. And Ezekiel has had some leaders of Israel that are already in exile come to him to ask that he check in with God about things for them. They're basically wanting God's guidance and assistance. And God's response is basically, how dare you? How dare you be idolaters in the heart and not repentant in your heart and come and worship me by asking things of me? And God says, I'm going to start sorting you out on that. I will put everyone under the rod, and I will know who are my people, and those that are not truly my people in the heart, they're out of here. They're gone. In fact, that's where we pick up. Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 39. As for you, O house of Israel, thus says he who is God, go, serve every one of your idols, now and hereafter, if you will not listen to me. But my holy name you shall no more profane with your gifts and your idols. So God is saying, I am done with you playing both sides against the middle. You need to choose this day whom you're going to serve. Either your idols or me, not both. Verse number 40, for on my holy mountain, the mountain height of Israel, declares he who is God, there all the house of Israel, all of them shall serve me in the land. Now, we have a little bit of a prophecy here of the time of the return. I think there's a little bit of that. But also, I think we have the ultimate time of return, which will be the second coming of Jesus and the setting up of the millennial period, which then leads into eternity itself, where God alone is ruling and reigning, and there are no other gods and goddesses anywhere to be seen. So on my holy mountain, which is typically a reference to Israel and specifically to Jerusalem, where God's name is associated, on my holy mountain, the mountain height of Israel, declares he who is God, there all the house of Israel, all of them, shall serve me in the land. There I will accept them. There I will require your contributions and the choicest of your gifts with all your sacred offerings. As a pleasing aroma, I will accept you when I bring you out of the peoples and gather you out of the countries where you've been scattered, and I will manifest my holiness among you in the sight of the nations. And you shall know that I am he who is, when I bring you into the land of Israel, the country that I swore to give to your fathers. So again, this has got a lot to do with the return out of Assyrian and Babylonian exile. This is all going to revolve around the things that happened under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest and Ezra the prophet scribe and priest and also Nehemiah. These guys are all going to be involved in bringing people back to the land of Israel and getting things started fresh again so that the Messiah can come. And then, of course, when the Messiah comes the next time around, there will be a trumpet sound called out to gather his people out of the graves and from around the world to meet him by Mount of Olives at Jerusalem to establish the eternal kingdom. So I think there's a mixture of time periods in view here in the passage. Verse 43, there you shall remember your ways and all your deeds with which you've defiled yourselves, and you shall loathe yourselves for all the evils that you have committed. So the phraseology is, when you guys come back out of exile, when the descendants of these guys come back out of exile, they will be ashamed of the history that took them into exile. And well, they should be. Verse 44, "And you shall know that I am he who is, when I deal with you for my name's sake, not according to your evil ways, nor according to your corrupt deeds, O house of Israel, declares he who is God." Now remember, the earlier context of this chapter is basically that God has always been more gracious to these people, these Israelis, in their sinful state than what could have happened. And so once again, he says that will be the case later, that I have been more gracious than I have been judgmental. Verse 45, "And the word of he who is came to me, Son of man, set your face..." Oh, excuse me, I'm getting ahead of my story here too fast. That's for later. So we're going to save that for another place. At this point, I think we go back to chapter 14, verse number 12, because these two chapters seem to be paralleling the same time period, and finish up with what God says there. Ezekiel 14:12. "The word of he who is came to me, Son of man, when a land sins against me by acting faithlessly, and I stretch out my hand against it and break its supply of bread and send famine upon it and cut off from it man and beast." So this is going to be a prediction that when God, using Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians, brings judgment specifically against Jerusalem, but also against Judea as a whole, famine is going to set in, because the Babylonians are going to set up this siege, and sieges work because of the lack of supplies, lack of food and water. And so God says to Ezekiel, when that happens in just a few more years, verse 14, "Even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver but their own lives by their righteousness, declares he who is God." So God says, when this next famine hits, even if three famous prayer people were there, Noah, who of course was faithful, so much so that he and his family were the only ones that survived through the flood, and Daniel, who is just recently become very famous because of his prayer life and his faith life, he, even though he was a young man, you know, a teenager, maybe just beginning in his 20s, he was promoted to be the leader over all the wise men of Babylon. He's the second in command of all of Babylon. So even if he were here, or Job, who was a very famous man, we talk about the patience of Job, and he ends up praying for his, quote, friends, end quote, at the end of that story, because God struck them for their unfaithfulness, their false information. And Job prayed for them, and they were saved. So God says, even if these three famous, faithful prayers were in the kingdom of Judah, they would only be able to pray and save themselves. Verse 15. If I cause wild beasts to pass through the land and they ravage it, and it be made desolate, so that no one may pass through because of the beasts. And that's also a common thing that happens during times of warfare and times of pestilence. The people die off, or the people run away, and the wild animal population kind of starts taking over the cities and the built-up areas. And then it becomes dangerous to go back in there. Most recent famous part of that from the perspective of this time period was when the Assyrians emptied the northern kingdom of Israel of all the Israelis. It took them a few years to get other populations relocated there. And in the meantime, the wild animal population, particularly the lions, exploded. And so they were attacking people right and left. So that's what God's talking about here. Once that happens with Judah, even if these three men were in it, as I live, declares he who is God, they would deliver neither sons nor daughters. They alone would be delivered, but the land would be desolate. So Noah, Daniel, and good old Job would only be able to save themselves, nobody else. Verse 17, or if I bring a sword upon that land and say, let a sword pass through the land, and I cut off from it man and beast, though these three men were in it, as I live, declares he who is God, they would deliver neither sons nor daughters, but they alone would be delivered. So when the sword of war comes, these guys, these famous prayer faithful people, would only save themselves. Or if I send a pestilence into that land and pour out my wrath upon it with blood to cut off from it man and beast, even if Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, declares he who is God, they would deliver neither son nor daughter, they would deliver but their own lives by their righteousness. So this is all because God's judgment is not going to go away. It's a sure thing. That's the point here. There is no way that God is going to back off on the coming of the Babylonians. For thus says he who is God, how much more when I send upon Jerusalem my four disastrous acts of judgment, sword, famine, wild beast, and pestilence, to cut off from it man and beast. But behold, some survivors will be left in it, sons and daughters who will be brought out. Behold, when they come out to you, and you see their ways and their deeds, you will be consoled for the disaster that I have brought upon Jerusalem, for all that I have brought upon it. They will console you when you see their ways and their deeds, and you shall know that I have not done without cause all that I've done in it, declares he who is God. Keep in mind that the primary receivers of this message, people already living in exile in Babylon. So they will be there after the siege is over with, when the final survivors and exiles come out of Judah and Jerusalem to join them. And they will have stories to tell. And so God says, when those guys show up, then you'll know all this happened because it was fair, because it needed to happen, because the sins were bad. Since we're here, and since it's possible that the next couple of chapters come from this same time period, that is, shortly before the rebellion of Zedekiah happens and the beginning of the siege happens, we're just going to go ahead and do it now. So let's think about these things probably happening or being written down or being spoken right around 592, 591, somewhere in that neighborhood. Ezekiel 15, the word of he who is came to me. Son of man, how does the wood of the vine surpass any wood, the vine branch that is among the trees of the forest? So he wants him to think, comparing the types of wood that you get from different types of plants. Verse 3, is wood taken from it to make anything? That is, do they take grapevine wood and use it to make useful things, like they do hardwood of trees? For example, here's the next question. Do people take a peg from it to hang any vessel on it? And the answer is no, you don't. It's not suitable to those sorts of things. Grapevines might make beautiful wreaths and decorations like that, but you don't really want to use them for anything that needs to be supported. Behold, it is given to the fire for fuel. That's what they like to use it for. When the fire has consumed both ends of it and the middle of it is charred, it is useful. Is it useful for anything? Behold, when it was whole, it was used for nothing. How much less when the fire has consumed it and it's charred can it ever be used for anything? So you throw it in the fire, but it only gets partially burned up. The two ends are charred. The middle is still there. It's kind of a little bit burned up. Is it useful then? And the answer is no, it wasn't useful to begin with. Why would burning it with fire make it more useful? Verse 6, therefore, thus says he who is God, like the wood of the vine among the trees of the forest, which I have given to the fire for fuel, so have I given up the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And I will set my face against them. Though they escape from the fire shall yet consume them. And you will know that I am he who is when I set my face against them. And I will make the land desolate because they've acted faithlessly, declares he who is God. So I guess the point here is that the people before the judgment of God through the Babylonian starts, these guys, these idolaters, they're sinners, and they're not useful to God. They're not beneficial. They're a problem. And then when God sicks the Babylonians on them and brings the fires of judgment, these guys are not going to repent. Most of them aren't. Most of them are going to be begging God to save them, right along with begging their other gods and goddesses of the idols to save them. So they're not going to change their behavior. Some of them right up till they die. And so God's point is, they weren't useful to me before the judgment came, and they won't be useful to me once the judgment takes them away. Chapter 16. Again, the word of he who is came to me. Son of man, make known to Jerusalem her abominations. And I guess at this point, I haven't given this warning lately, and sometimes I may have needed to do so. Some of the things in these prophetic books of this time period are pretty graphic because they're supposed to be in your face, shocking, to try to slap these people to reality. And so if you've got younger listeners, this is probably not some of the best material for them. This is a much more PG-13 sort of discussion and study. So you might want to turn off the radio and check the internet later for your own study time, or chase the kids into the other room and keep on doing your own study here. Fair warning. Now let's go back to it again. Son of man, make known to Jerusalem her abominations, and say, thus says he who is God to Jerusalem, your origin and your birth are of the land of the Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite, and your mother a Hittite. Now, what we have here is a poetic, it is an extended parable to describe the type of lifestyle and mindset Israel has had. Now, their literal father was from Mesopotamia. That would be Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. These guys are from that gene pool up in that direction. But speaking from a spiritual background. They're acting like Canaanites. They're acting like the Amorites and the Hittites that used to live in the land that God brought judgment upon because of their sinfulness. So that's what he says. He says, you guys are like Canaanites to me. Verse 4, as for your birth, on the day you were born, your cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water to cleanse you, nor rubbed with salt, nor wrapped in swaddling clothes. No, I pitied you to do any of these things to you out of compassion for you, but you were cast out into the open field, for you were abhorred on the day that you were born. So this is God's way of saying, when you first came into existence in Canaan, you know, in the days of Jacob and Joseph and the brothers. The brothers were not very good guys, were they? You guys were like an unwanted kid. When you were born, nobody did anything with your umbilical cord. Now, when a child was born in a situation where they were wanted back at this time, there would be like a doula, a maid that was professionally gifted in taking care of newborns. And she'd be like right there to tie something around the umbilical cord so that the placenta then would then deliver, and then they would snip that umbilical cord at just the right spot. And then they'd wash the baby with good clean water, and then they'd rub them down with salt because they thought that would help kind of make the skin a little tougher to deal with life. And then they'd wrap them up tight in swaddling clothes, kind of like a full body diaper, keeping their arms and their legs, you know, really tight to kind of help them feel like they were still in the womb. So it was a swaddling thing. But for these guys, nobody cared about them. Nobody. Nobody cared about this family group. And then God comes along. That's how it's portrayed. When I passed by you and saw you wallowing in your blood, I said to you in your blood, live! I said to you in your blood, live! So God wanted this baby. I made you flourish like a plant of the field, and you grew up and became tall and arrived at full adornment. So over time, Israel grew up as a nation. You know, they were down in Egypt, and then God brought them out of Egypt, and they were now supposed to be more mature. Here comes some stuff that's a little bit strange to us to hear. Your breasts were formed and your hair had grown, yet you were naked and bare. So God pictures Israel going through adolescence, suddenly growing breasts and having pubic hair and hair under the arms and things like that to show that they were now old enough, they were beginning to be old enough that they could be considered for marriage. And that's what comes up next. When I passed by you again and saw you, that is, saw you as a full-grown nation, behold, you were of the age for love, and I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, declares he who is God, and you became mine. The spreading of the garment, the corner of the garment over a person, wasn't just simply the covering of the nakedness. That's part of the story here. But it was also the ancient Israeli way of extending an offer of marriage to someone. For example, in the book of Ruth, when Boaz asked Ruth what she was doing there in the middle of the night by his feet, she'd already been schooled to say, cover me with the corner of your garment, for you are my kinsman redeemer, which was basically, ask me to marry you. Make the commitment to marry me. The garment would always have those purple prominences that mark the covenant. And so that's what we're seeing here too, is that God married or made the offer of marriage to Israel at this time in her history. That's when he brought her out of Egypt. He was bringing her out to marry her. And this gets a little bit confusing, I understand, because more often than not, we hear Israel being talked about as a guy, and that's perfectly appropriate. But other times, like here, she's seen as a bride. So, continuing, I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, declares he who is God, and you became mine. And then I bathed you with water and washed off your blood from you and anointed you with oil. I clothed you also with embroidered cloth and shod you with fine leather. So I gave you great clothing and great shoes after we got married. And then I put a ring in your nose, because that's where the wedding ring used to go in Israeli culture, and earrings in your ears and a beautiful crown on your head. And thus you were adorned with gold and silver, and your clothing was of fine linen and silk and embroidered cloth. You ate fine flour and honey and oil. You grew exceedingly beautiful and advanced to royalty, and your renown went forth among all the nations because of your beauty, for it was perfect through the splendor that I'd bestowed on you, declares he who is God. So God says in this extended parable, in this story here, I saved you when you were a baby. I made a betrothal to you in your adulthood, and then I married you and blessed you beyond belief. But then God has to talk about how they responded.